yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today, a host of topics on the agenda here. A lot happening. Let's start with interest rates and the Federal Reserve. Next week, about to lower rates, almost guaranteed that that will happen. The only question is by how much. Talk is maybe a quarter of 1%, or maybe even a half of 1%. Well, why the aggressive move here by the Fed? What's going on? Is the economy collapsing? You know, last time we had a half a percent drop was 2008 in the crash. Well, what's happening is the Fed has capitulated to the banking industry and to Trump. A little bit of recent history here. You know what happened in the second half of last year, towards the end of last year, is that the stock market began to collapse. It went down 30% in just a little over a month. Everyone started to panic in the administration. Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, calls in some big bankers who we don't know, secret meeting in Washington the week before Christmas. And that same week, within 24 hours of their meeting, Trump threatens to fire Fed Chairman Powell if he doesn't stop raising rates. You know, the Fed had raised rates four times in the course of 2018, and that rate increase is what precipitated the stock market correction. At the same time, you know, the tax cuts for corporate investors began to dissipate towards the end of the year. So we had a double whammy here. We had a decline of the subsidization of the stock markets through the Fed through the Trump tax bill, which was passed in January of 18, that subsidized stocks big time, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts for corporations and investors and wealthy 1%. And that boosted the stock market. How did it boost the stock market? Well, you know, with those big tax cuts, corporate profits were, bottom line, were boosted 23%. Corporate S&P 500 corporate profits last year, up about 27% in 1 year. 23% of that was bottom line boost from the tax cuts. Well, flush with all that extra cash, what did the corporations do? Well, they bought back their stock and paid out dividends. So the tune of $1.3 trillion, well, that's what boosted the stock market all through last year. It was the big subsidization from the tax cuts. Well, that began to dissipate by the end of the year at the same time the Fed was raising rates. So we had a double whammy there that caused stocks to make this big contraction. Well, that's why Trump and investors stepped in. Don't think it was just Trump's decision. You know, too coincidental, smoking gun, you know. They rushed to Washington there. They meet with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. And a day later, Trump issues his worst threat to Powell. You know, either stop raising rates or I'm going to fire you. Well, he stopped raising rates within a week. You know, he pedaled on down to the White House on Trump's request. And within a week, early January, what did we get? We get an announcement from Powell that, oh, we're going to hold off. We're going to be patient. You know, that was the signal. We're going to hold off. Well, then what happens to the stocks in the first quarter last year? Well, they surged right back up, recovered like three-fourths of it. But then we get to May and we get signs of a growing slowdown in the global economy, and we get a blow-up of the China-U.S. trade deal engineered by the neocons there in May. Oh, well, then the stock market goes into a funk again, but only for a couple of weeks, because then Trump presses Powell once again, and then Powell starts signaling in June, well, you know, we're probably going to cut rates. And ever since then, under the promise of rate cuts, the stock market has continued to rise. Well, you know, the official line in the Fed and academics is that, the Fed does not target financial markets in its decisions. Oh, and the Fed is independent. Yeah, two fictions about monetary policy. And the past year should pretty much refute the first, that the Fed does not respond to markets, because of course it has. It's all it's been doing. And the second fiction about the Fed is independent, the question is, independent of whom? Well, it appears as if Trump is trying to break the independence fiction. Well, he already has. But behind Trump, you know, are the investors who pressure the administration. You know, you don't hear and see about that much. That stuff is kept all bottled up, right? You don't get that in the media and the press. Well, in my book, Central Bank is the End of Rope, I argue very clearly that examples and so forth historically that the Federal Reserve was created for the banks, and it was actually run by the banks first two decades. Only the Great Depression put in the fiction of government independence and banker independence with the reforms in 1935 of the Federal Reserve. But that was just a cover. You know, when it comes to the strategic shifts, which we're seeing now, the banking industry has a big say. And the banks still control the districts of the Federal Reserve. My book just passed March, Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed, talks about how this all came about. All right, so now we're on a new track after just a couple years of trying to reverse what was zero interest rates effectively for years from 2009 all the way to 2016. Banks could borrow from the Fed, including shadow banks, you know, hedge funds, so forth. They could borrow from the bank, from the Federal Reserve at virtually zero cost. Yeah, 0.15 of 1% was what the interest cost to borrow from the Fed. Free money, 6 years. Okay, so that distorted all kinds of financial markets, which is still distorted in the U.S. The money was so cheap that non-bank companies, you know, were able to borrow money from banks, who would then pass on, you know, the 0.15 and maybe charge them 1 or 2%. You know, they would borrow money from the banks to buy back their stock. Yeah. Or to issue corporate bonds. Corporate bonds with very low interest rates, the proceeds from which they would then use to pay out dividends and buy back their stocks. That's how we got $1 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts from 2011 up to 2016, 17. And then last year, $1.3 trillion. And this year, it's going to be $1.5 trillion. See, that's how it all works. You know, that's how the Federal Reserve and the monetary system, central bank, works to subsidize banks, financial institutions, who in turn then pass the subsidization on to private corporations, non-bank corporations, who then divvy out the money in stock buybacks and dividend payouts to shareholders. And that's how you get this massive income inequality. You see, it's the 1% at the top that ends up with all this. Because they're the ones who own the stock, or most of it, and the bonds. You can trace it, how monetary policy subsidizes capital incomes massively. That's the main characteristic of 21st century U.S. capitalism, this massive monetary subsidization. Well, what happened in 2016-17 is the Federal Reserve very carefully started putting its toe in the water here on raising rates, because if the rates were down so low, what would they do to the next recession? They would have no way to lower rates. So they started, you know, very tepidly raising rates, and they got the rates up to 2.375, 2.375%. Here at the peak. Now they're about to come down from that. Well, 2.375, that's not much leeway to lower rates, is it? Because now that's all over. There's another big shift now, the lower rates. And some are predicting, some big finance capitalists are predicting that U.S. rates in the next recession will go negative once again, like Europe, already negative. 65% of all government bonds are negative. Well, what that means is that if you want to put your money, if you're a bank in Europe and you want to put your money in the ECB, the European Central Bank, which you have to put some in to keep reserves, well, then you got to pay the ECB to put your money there. That's what negative rates mean. You got to pay. You don't get an interest on your money. You pay. 65% of all bonds, government bonds, sovereign bonds, are in negative territory in Europe. And now the ECB is going to follow the Fed, as it always does. As soon as they get a new chairperson there, officially in the seat, they're going to lower rates too. They got to lower rates if the U.S. is lowering rates, because if they don't, their currency, you know, the euro, will be more expensive than the dollar, and that means they're going to lose exports to the U.S. Well, they can't do that. Europe's even more dependent on exports, so they're going to lower rates too. Well, that's going to drive even more government bonds into negative territory. You know, we'll have 80% maybe. And since the ECB not only buys and sells government bonds, it does so with private corporate bonds. And we're already seeing negative rates beginning in corporate bonds in Europe. You see, the Federal Reserve of the U.S. only buys government bonds, buys and sells government bonds right now. Well, next recession is going to start buying and selling corporate bonds, I predict, as well, just like Europe, because its task is to subsidize capital incomes. And in a recession, the stock markets and bond markets will decline sharply. And to protect those investments, the price of those investments for wealthy investors, it will start buying bonds. Or, like the Bank of Japan, which not only buys government bonds and corporate bonds, but buys stocks. Yeah, the Bank of Japan is really subsidizing financial markets and has been for some time. It buys everything. It becomes the big gorilla buyer on the market there and keeps the stock market values up. Oh, yeah, well, central banks don't have anything to do with targeting markets. They target the 2% inflation for real goods and services. Oh, their job is to make sure there's employment. Oh, what a fiction. What a lie. Yeah, well, that's where we're headed. You know, I think this big finance capitalist named Bass, big hedge fund guy, last week predicted next recession, we're going into negative rates as well. That means you're not going to get anything on your savings. You know, CDs and savings and whatever will be zero. There'll be no, you'll be putting your money into banks just for a place to put it other than under your mattress. Yeah, that's coming too. And that's going to whack seniors and retirees, you know, who rely on at least a little bit of a return. You know, 401ks, forget it, going to collapse. And defined benefit pensions, of which there aren't too many left, the pension funds will be in deep doo-doo once again. And the big draconian measure being prepared in the back rooms, already been prepared in the U.S. and U.K., is to bail out the banks using your money. Yeah. In other words, depositors' money. They'll force you to use your deposits in the banks, which won't be producing any interest, to buy bank stock. That's called bail-ins instead of bailouts, you see. Well, that's coming. That's coming in the next recession. So once again, you know, the central banks are at the center of all this. You know, and the Fed drives global central bank rates. Already in anticipation of the Fed rate cut next week, you know, banks around the world, central banks are cutting their rates as well, you know, in Australia and different places. Yeah, they're anticipating. The Federal Reserve drives rates around the world because interest rates drive the value of the currency. You know, if rates decline, there's less purchases of dollars by offshore investors to invest in the U.S. You see, if you're an offshore capitalist and you want to put your money in a safe place in the U.S., you got to buy bonds, government bonds or whatever in the U.S., but you got to do it with dollars. You can't use your Argentinian peso. So you got to take your peso and you got to go to global money markets and buy dollars, and after you buy the dollars, then you can buy the U.S. bonds or corporate bonds or stocks or whatever. And when the rest of the world economy is slowing faster than the U.S., investors want to get their money out of their own economies and put it in the safe place, which is the U.S. So they start buying dollars to do so. Okay, what does that do? That dumps their currency on the market, increases the supply of their currency, which lowers the price of their currency, the value of their currency, and increased demand for dollars raises dollars, the value of dollars, of the dollar. And we see that's what's going on right now. You see, the value of the dollar is rising because all this money is starting to flood in from around the world, buying dollars. Well, but the problem is, if the value of the dollar is rising because the rest of the global economy is slowing faster than the U.S. and money's flowing in, capital is fleeing from emerging markets coming to the U.S. and Europe, by the way, and Japan. If the money is fleeing those economies coming to the U.S., and the dollar is rising as a result, well, that makes U.S. exports less competitive. Because the value of the dollar rises, then all other currencies in relationship to the dollar decline in value. This is a good example is the Chinese yuan. The dollar has been rising, and the yuan has been, quote, devaluing. It moves in this band. It's at the peak of it right now. It's 7 to a dollar, roughly. 7 yuan to a dollar. And if the dollar rises much more, well, then it's going to break that band, and it'll go to 7 point something or 8, whatever. There'll be a devaluation. You could easily get a 10% devaluation on the yuan. Well, if the yuan devalues, Chinese exports become more competitive vis-a-vis U.S. And that negates pretty much Trump's tariffs. Yeah, very easy. The Chinese can get out from under Trump's 10-25% tariffs by allowing their currency to devalue. Pretty much just offset it. Well, Trump is terrified that that's going to happen, because if that happens, then the Chinese can just sit back and wait on this trade deal, which they're doing already. And Trump desperately wants some sort of agreement before the 2020 elections. But as I said before in a show and written in articles, the latest on my blog, jackrasmus.com, is the Chinese are in no hurry now. That the neocons, U.S. neocons, anti-China hardliners, blew up negotiations this past May. Yeah, the U.S. had put such onerous last-minute conditions on a deal that the Chinese just couldn't capitulate, so they walked away. What were these onerous deals? Well, I've talked about them before on this show, but basically saying the U.S. said in the last week before the Chinese are coming over, it said to the Chinese, you know, look, we're going to keep some of these tariffs anyway. We're going to keep the tariffs anyway, even if we have a deal. And the Chinese understood that, well, Trump, you're going to, you know, remove your tariffs if we have a deal. No, no, he's going to keep the tariffs. On top of that, the U.S. negotiators said, look, we have a new demand here on this technology transfer. You not only have to stop requiring tech transfer in your country, but, you know, you got to share your next generation technology development with us. Also, Trump said, well, look, you know, even if we have a deal, we're still going to go after some of your companies like Huawei and others. That's not on the table. And we got the Canadians to arrest the co-chairperson of Huawei. And, oh, that's going to be settled in the courts. We can't do anything about that. And we may go after some of your other companies, too. Oh, and by the way, China, you know, you got to stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises because we don't subsidize ours. Yeah, sure. Trillion-dollar tax cuts. We don't subsidize our corporations. Export-import bank. No, we don't subsidize our corporations. So these were the last-minute onerous conditions imposed on the Chinese just as they were coming over. And, of course, you know, there was no deal, and China is pretty much refusing to go through this charade of negotiations. They would like a deal. They've offered big concessions, you know, concessions on U.S. ownership, majority ownership in China, concessions on buying $1 trillion more farm goods in 5 years. Big concessions. But the neocons want the Chinese to capitulate on the technology issue, and they're not going to do that. And now they won't come back, you see. Oh, there's phone conversations going on between Mnuchin. They'll talk to Mnuchin, you see, but they don't want to talk to Lighthizer, Navarro, and some of those other neocons that keep scuttling negotiations twice now. They had a deal the year earlier in 2018, and the neocons scuttled that. And now they scuttled the latest one as well. Neocons don't want a deal on trade with China. They want a capitulation on the tech issue, because the tech issue is military, you see, and the neocons behind them have the military-industrial complex in the U.S. and the military, the Pentagon, they're all, and friends in Congress. You know, it's not just individual neocons. You know, there's big forces behind this. They're terrified that next generation technologies, you know, 5G and cybersecurity, AI, military technologies in the next decade will allow the Chinese to leapfrog the U.S. militarily. And that's what the fight is about, you see. This is not just a trade war or a tariff war. It's not even a trade war. It's just a tariff war, you know, because other measures could be brought to bear that are trade-related, like devaluing your currency, you know, or not buying U.S. bonds, government bonds. Chinese not buying bonds or slowing down their buying of bonds. You know, that would turn the tariff war into a trade war, and eventually into an economic war. We're kind of in an economic war with China, and it's over technology, you see. You could solve the trade war, the tariff war, pretty quick, but you can't solve the technology war between China and the U.S., and you won't be able to. And the only question is, will Trump grab what he can before the election next year from the Chinese, sign a deal even without technology capitulation by the Chinese? Will he take it, what he's got, and run? Well, if he does, he'll come back again later to get the rest, the bite of the apple. But maybe he won't. Maybe he won't even settle for majority ownership and $1 trillion or more farm good purchases. Maybe he won't do that, you know, and he'll just blame the recession next year on the Chinese. Yeah, he might do that. Either way, you know, those are the two things that are going to happen. But it's not going to happen this year. No way, no deal this year. Maybe he'll take the money and run, so to speak, next year. Maybe not. But those are the two outcomes at this point. Only two outcomes. Okay, so the trade war, because of the currency issue, is related, you know, indirectly, but fundamentally, to Federal Reserve monetary policy. Raising or lowering interest rates affect the value of the dollar in relationship to the Chinese currency, you know, which may or may not offset Trump tariffs. So you see, the two are tied together here. And Trump is pushing. He's pushing now, as we know, to get the Fed to lower rates, which he's accomplished. But he's also starting to push now to get the U.S. Treasury to lower the value of the dollar even faster. Lower rates will lower the value of the dollar. But the Treasury could take other moves, you know, entering into global markets and buying or selling dollars to affect the value of the dollar as well. If it sells dollars, if the Treasury sells dollars on global markets, it will lower the value of the dollar even more. You know, it's the supply and demand here affecting price. Excess supply lowers the value, the price, right? Excess demand raises the value, the price. So if the Treasury dumps dollars, that will lower the value of the dollar and offset any attempts by the Chinese to devalue their currency to offset the tariffs. Yeah, a little complicated, but, you know, it's all connected. It's not impossible to understand. Well, that's where we are. You know, Trump has indicated, put up a trial balloon. He's thinking of getting the Treasury to lower the dollar even faster than interest rates. Well, but that, you know, really means you lower the value of the dollar. That really means that other countries, Europe and so forth, are squeezed even more. It means their economies are worse unless they can lower their currency even faster. There's another advantage to lowering the value of the dollar here, and why American business is behind Trump on this: lower rates, lower dollar. And that is, if you're a multinational company doing business, let's say in Argentina again, right, or Brazil or whatever, you're earning profits in that local currency. But you want to repatriate those profits, bring them back to the U.S. Well, if you've earned it in the currency, right, that has devalued more than the dollar, right? You got to spend more of your profits to convert them to dollars, so your profits in dollars go down. Multinational companies, you know, don't like a rising value of the dollar. And again, the dollar's rising because money's flooding in from around the world, right? They don't like that because it lowers their profits in dollars when they try to repatriate them. Yeah. So, it's a benefit to lower rates and to lower the value of the dollar for multinational U.S. corporations around the world. So they're lobbying for this. Well, we'll see what happens. But it's an indication that Trump is quite worried here. He's got to drive down the dollar. He's got to drive down interest rates. And he's putting all kind of pressure in order to bring that about. Because if it doesn't, it's going to run counter to his China-U.S. trade tariff policies. All right, so we'll watch what happens next week. Next week, the Fed will lower. The ECB will follow. If recession follows within the next 6 months, we'll then watch these rates go into negative territory. And negative rates just cause all kind of heartburn for banks. Yeah, it costs them. It undermines their profits. And that's why banks are opposed to this driving down the value of the dollar into rates. Well, we'll see what happens. But this is a major development underway that's going to contribute to pressures for the recession that's coming around the corner that more and more are talking about. Okay, let's move the topic to drugs, prescription drugs. Yeah, this past week, interesting, what we got this past week was Trump's tepid, weak solution to the problem of escalating drug prices, which had been going on and on and on since 2005. His solution was to increase competition among pharma companies. You see, Big Pharma runs on the basis of monopoly. Yeah, if they come up with a new drug, they get a patent on the drug. That's a monopoly. No one else can create that drug and sell that drug. That's theirs. And there's no competition. And when you got no competition, you can raise the price whatever you want because you know there's no one to undermine it with a similar product at a lower price. Yeah, the whole patent system is behind this run-up in prescription drugs. Well, you know, what's also driving it is the fact that these pharma companies are trying to merge and acquire each other, not just in the U.S., but globally, the big ones. And to buy up their competitors, quote, competitors, it means they get into another line of prescription drugs, to buy them up, they've got to borrow from Wall Street. And Wall Street says, we want to see 25% profit rates here before we give you our money. So if they got a monopoly and a patent on their other drugs, they just raise the price and please Wall Street. And Wall Street gives them the money to buy up their competition. And that's a big factor driving up pharma costs and prices. But, you know, they also now they are dealing with an administration that is so friendly, the big business, that they can jack up the prices even more and nothing's going to happen to them. So Trump had put forward a couple of months ago this weak-kneed solution to create competition. That's what all this generic drug stuff was supposed to be about. Hasn't had an effect much on price. So Trump proposed this week. It's improve competition by letting folks know what these prices are beforehand so they can shop around, you know. A competitive market solution to the price problem. Well, the pharma companies didn't even like that. And what they did was put pressure on Trump, and he withdrew that. He withdrew that last week. You know, that simple, tepid proposal. You know, and more, it's catching fire. More and more, these drug companies are just jacking up prices hundreds and thousands of percent. You know, the latest one is insulin prices. There's millions of you, tens of millions probably, Americans who are diabetic, who have to buy insulin to stay alive. But that prices are going through the roof. Yeah. And what's being done about it? Nothing. Virtually nothing. Oh, you know, we got these states are suing companies that still create these opioids, you know, fentanyl, OxyContin, and so forth. And now it's coming out that they knew all along this stuff was being overprescribed, and they just wanted the sales, and they just kept pumping out, you know, fentanyl and so forth, got people addicted big time, which meant they bought even more. They knew this for over a decade going on. They knew it, and they still pumped it out. And the doctors kept prescribing, particularly in certain parts of the country, you know. The Washington Post had an article, and there's a database that they got hold of that shows where most of these drugs were being prescribed. You know, it's not the same all across the country. And where most of the deaths from opioids resulted. And what are we talking about, deaths from opioids? Well, just from prescription opioids, latest data showed last year, 32,000 Americans died from prescribed opioids like fentanyl and OxyContin. 32,000 in 1 year. Yeah, prescribed, right? 47,000 from some kind of opioid. In other words, some street overdose and so forth, 47,000. But 32,000 of the 47 were prescribed by doctors. In other words, not someone shooting up heroin on the street corner, but your local doctor. Yeah. And in fact, 12,000 of the 32,000 were just opioids that you could buy, common opioids. Not even fentanyl and OxyContin, you know, but 32,000. 47,000 total opioid deaths in the United States, 47,000. And if you throw in other kind of prescription drugs, overdose deaths, right, the total comes to 68,557 people last year died from overprescribed drugs. You know, over half of which are fentanyl and OxyContin. 68,000. Hey, folks, you know, that's in 1 year. We lost fewer than that over 8 years in the Vietnam War. Yeah, we have a Vietnam War going on every year and more in the U.S. right now because of overprescribed drugs. The vast majority of which are these prescribed opioids. And no one has gone to jail. Yeah, we're killing 68,000 of our fellow citizens, the drug companies are killing 68,000 people a year. And nothing's done about it. Oh, they have these big state attorney generals going after the drug companies, you know, in a few states in Oklahoma and so forth where it's been concentrated, right? But they're now settling for pennies, pennies. You know, it's just the cost of doing business by these drug companies, and they'll raise their price to recoup the fines. And nothing's really happening in Washington to do it. So the states are going after it. You know, like I said a minute ago, it's very clearly not something that's happening equally across the country. It's concentrated. Where is it concentrated? Mostly in the South. South, Southwest, mid, you know, plain states, to some extent out west, you know, places like Utah, New Mexico. Those are mostly Native American Indian reservations, probably. A little bit in Washington. But mostly it's in this arc. All these deaths in this arc from Virginia, West Virginia, down through the South out to Texas. That's where most of these opioid deaths are occurring. Red states, in other words, folks, red states. 68,000 Americans killed every year because of drug companies. Big Pharma. At the same time, Big Pharma is jacking up prices all the way across the board. It's a double crisis. The drug crisis is a double crisis. It's a crisis of killing people. You know, a lot of diabetics won't be able to afford to buy their insulin, and people will be dying, and they won't be added to these ranks, but they will be killed by pharma. Yeah. And then we got these opioid deaths. Nearly 50,000 a year occurring, a Vietnam War every year occurring in the U.S. And, you know, we didn't even add the number of people who are being killed from guns. You know, that's 30,000 plus. You know, and easily people must, we must have at least 20,000 killed by other negligent products. You know, we got 100,000 people being murdered every year in this country by big business. Nothing's done. Nothing's done. Okay, what's the solution towards this big pharma crisis here we've got going? How do they raise their prices? Well, as I said, they got a monopoly oftentimes, which enables them to control the supply and therefore raise the price. Another tactic is they start a company. Usually hedge fund guys will start a company or buy up a little company, a little pharma company out there that had a drug that was, like aspirin or something, that it didn't raise prices on, been there a long time. And they buy up that company, and then they jack up the price by thousands of percent. And that's what this guy Martin Shkreli did, you know, this scumbag. He was a hedge fund guy. Bought up this little company that was charging like $10, $15 for this one drug, and raised it 1,000%. Yeah. Well, he was so egregious that he got thrown in jail. But not because of what he did with the drug, but because he bilked some of his other investors, cheated them. That's what they got him on. So it wasn't because of jacking up the price and killing people. No, it was because he didn't play fair with his other capitalist buddies. But that's not the only way they manipulate the patents, you see. It's coming out that one of the ways they continue to extend their patents, and therefore their monopolies, is to simply repackage it, repackage the drug, give it another package, you know, and patent that. And that enables them to keep the monopoly, manipulating the patent laws, and they get away with it. Look, you're not going to have any solution to this problem with Big Pharma until we create a government pharmaceutical investment corporation. Let the government compete with these guys, right? Let the government use the National Institutes of Health or something, you know, to create a government corporation that will invest in cancer drugs or whatever, next generation, invest in it, and really compete with these guys. You know, it's like the public option in healthcare, but on the drug side. Okay, so we'll have more and more of this terrible crisis here on the Big Pharma. Big Pharma, by the way, is one of the biggest lobbyist spenders, you see, and campaign contributors. Yeah. Big money. They spend big money. Well, they got to raise the price to pay for all these contributions, you know, and their lobbying activities. Okay. So what else is of interest here? Well, what we see is more and more intercapitalist global conflicts rising here. Not only the trade war by Trump. Right. Yeah, look, this Trump trade war is to all about rewriting the rules of international trade and money, investment flows, rewrite the rules as the global economy moves into the next phase and is slowing down. Rewrite the rules so that U.S. capitalists remain in the driver's seat, as they have since 1944, as far as the global economy is concerned. Ensure the dollar remains the hegemonic currency, trading and reserve currency, and fends off challenges by other currencies in that regard. It's all about maneuvering for the next decade going on. Change the rules of the game. That's what Trump's trying to do. And big corporations are fully behind him on this, by the way. Don't think they're not. Right. We see competition intensifying between capitalists globally as well in the oil industry here, right? U.S. shale producers are grabbing market share from OPEC and Russia and small producers by pumping out more and more low-priced oil from the U.S. The U.S. is now totally self-sufficient because of shale production, which, of course, requires massive amounts of water and is draining the aquifers in Texas and Oklahoma, Kansas, and places like that. People are going to run out of water eventually because the aquifers will be gone here probably another decade. But, you know, right now they're making all kind of profit. They don't care. South Korea and Japan are in a spat over trade. Of course, the U.S. and Mexico and Canada, you know, this latest, quote, deal, NAFTA 2.0, which isn't resolved. And we saw Trump continue to wield the threat of tariffs over Mexico here with this immigration farce, right? There's disputes with U.S. and Canada over aluminum and steel still. Germany, the U.S. putting pressure on Germany not to buy Russian gas and to cancel the pipeline between Germany and Russia on gas. We see Europe going after U.S. tech companies, trying to get them to pay their fair share of taxes. They think in Europe they can do the same ripoffs they do in the U.S. and not pay taxes. U.S. attacking German banks, just as Europe is attacking American tech companies. The U.K. and Brexit. Huawei, the U.S. trying to get the Europeans to scuttle their Huawei deals. France taxing U.S. tech companies. Europe launching its own international payment system instead of using the U.S.-controlled SWIFT system, as it's called. I've introduced a new system called INSTEX as a way of getting around the U.S. and the SWIFT system to continue trading with Iranian oil, right? U.S. and Turkey in a toss-up here over Turkey buying Russian missiles, right? U.S. saying, oh, if you do that, you can't buy any more F-35 jets from the U.S. Well, you know, Turkey has been moving in that direction because the U.S. tried to instigate a coup, supported a coup a couple years ago in Turkey, and this guy Erdogan, president of Turkey, survived the coup, and he hasn't forgotten. Right? So he is doing all kinds of maneuvers here. And, of course, the U.S. is between a rock and a hard place. It supported the Kurds in Syria, and the Kurds and the Turks, of course, are mortal enemies. So how does the U.S. extricate itself from that, having supported the Kurds, which it needs to keep a foothold of influence in Iraq? How does it satisfy both Turkey and the Kurds? It can't. It can't. So it's stuck there. Okay, so we see all these signs globally here of intensifying conflicts, trade, economic conflicts, sometimes political, which are all a consequence of the slowing global economy, really, and the U.S. upsetting the status quo by trying to reestablish new rules of the game. So we'll see more of that as well. What else of interest here? Well, Amazon announced a week or so ago that it was going to spend big bucks on job retraining for its warehouse workers. Yeah, it projects that 100,000 warehouse workers are going to lose their jobs to technology in the warehouses. So they're going to, quote, retrain them. Yeah, sure. You're going to take warehouse workers and make them into data scientists? You know, by giving them some reimbursement for tuition to go to community college? Or become software engineers? Because that's what Amazon needs and wants. It needs tech people, high-skilled tech people. That's where it makes most of its money, you know? Pentagon contracts, technology, cloud computing, storage, etc. Not a warehouse company, it's a tech company. And they can't get enough skilled people. And at the same time, they're working on all kind of projects to automate out the warehouses. Well, the latest thing they've developed here is automated packaging. Automated packaging. And they plan to cut 100,000 jobs. Well, now they're saying that they're going to put money in the pot to retrain these people. Yeah. No way you're going to retrain these people for high-tech jobs. Oh, but that's what they're saying. Okay. Trump, by the way, is also pushing for more tax cuts for his friends at the same time. Well, in what form? Well, indexing the capital gains, indexing to inflation and so forth. So in other words, the capital gains tax cuts will get even bigger over time if he does this indexing. And he doesn't have to go through Congress to do it. Yeah, that's another crumb he will throw to his big business buddies. And what about this all-out tack on the Affordable Care Act? What is that about? Well, it's always been about for corporations and the rich to get rid of this 3.8% investment tax, which was used partly to fund the ACA. That's why they hated the ACA, was these taxes on business, particularly the 3.8% on investment income. And they're going to get it, too. And now there's changes to the rules on 401ks that are coming. Yeah. Inheritance, right? Inheritance changes. So, you know, they're picking and choosing these relatively minor, but you add them all up, major additional tax cuts. It's always tax cuts for investors and corporations in the 1%. Quiet. On the side that you don't really see. Subsidize through the tax system, the wealthy and their investors. Subsidize the wealthy and the investors through reducing the cost of money. Fiscal monetary policy in the last decade since 2008 has changed fundamentally. It's no longer about trying to stabilize the economy to reduce inflation in real goods and services or to increase employment or to generate GDP. No, that's the textbook stuff that does no longer apply. It's all about subsidizing capital incomes. Because guess what? They're under pressure. Or they're just greedy. They want more. They got a lot and they want more. That's what capitalists are. They just want more. They're never satisfied. You know, the rich are never satisfied with all that they have. They want more because they can get it. They got the government now that will give it to them. And that's the reality. And watch the subsidization intensify when we go into the next recession, which I've always been predicting. Better 2-to-1 chance that it will emerge by the end of this year, certainly early in 2020. And that will be qualitatively different and possibly even worse than the 2008-09 crash and the consequences of all that we're still feeling. Well, now, you know, we're moving into an era here with the stock market where they're starting to focus on earnings, corporate earnings, you see, instead of the stock market being driven by subsidization through tax cuts and or the Fed. Now they're beginning to see, well, gee, earnings aren't rising even with all the subsidies. And that may precipitate the next major contraction of stock market, which could happen this year. Okay, so that's it for today for our show. And those are the things to be watching for. Watch for the Fed and other central banks. Watch for the value of the dollar and what happens there. Watch for these growing conflicts between capitalists. Watch for Big Pharma and what happens there. And watch for more tax cuts. At a time when very clearly, and I'll end on this note, that the Democratic Party leadership has been totally outmaneuvered by Trump and the Republicans. Outmaneuvered. Increasingly for years now, and now, obviously, the whole Mueller thing has been dropped, right? No impeachment, no more Mueller report, follow-up, obstruction of justice, none of that. It's all off the table. You know, Pelosi, Schumer have won, and the Democratic Party is going to go through a period of internal crisis. We'll be talking about that next week. Okay, this is Alternative Visions.